Hadrian picked up Thrace. A patch of moonlight showed a dark blemish on her face, a long, wide mark. He lifted her. Her head fell back, limp. Her arms and legs dangled free. She seemed dead. He handed her to Theron, who cradled his daughter to his chest and held her tight. Royce let loose the bit, and the horse thundered off, racing for the open field, leaving Royce and Hadrian behind.
"Think Millie's around?" Hadrian whispered.
"I think Millie is already an appetizer."
"I suppose the good news is that she bought Thrace and Theron safe passage."
They slowly moved to the edge of the wood. They were very close to where Dillon and his boys had been hauling logs earlier that day. They could see three of the six bonfires blazing away, illuminating the field.
"What about us?" Royce asked. "Do you think the Gilarabrin knows we're still in here?"
"Ezra Harden said it was intelligent, so I presume it can count."
"Then it'll come back and find us. We have to reach the castle. The distance across the open is about, what, 200 feet?
"About that," Royce confirmed.
"I guess we can hope it's still munching on Millie. Ready?"
"Run spread out so it can't get both of us."
"Go."
The grass was slick with dew and filled with stumps and pits. Hadrian got only a dozen yards before falling on his face.
"Stay behind me," Royce told him. "I thought we were spreading out. That's before I remembered you're blind."
They ran again, dodging in and out, as Royce picked the path up the hillside. They were nearly halfway across when they heard the bellows again. Thrump, thrump, thrump. The sound rushed toward them. Looking up, Hadrian saw something dark pass across the face of the rising moon, a serpent with bat-like wings gliding, arcing, circling like a hawk hunting mice in a field. The bellows stopped.
"It's diving!" Royce shouted.
A massive burst of wind blew them to the ground. The bonfires were instantly snuffed out. A second later, a loud rumble shook the earth, and a monolithic wall of green fire exploded in a great ring surrounding the entire hill. Astounding flames, 30 feet high, flashed up like trees of light spewing intense heat. No longer having any trouble seeing his way, Hadrian jumped to his feet and sped to the gate, Royce on his heels. Behind them, the flames roared. Above them, they heard a chilling scream. Dillon, Vince, and Russell slammed the gate shut the instant they were inside. The bonfire in the courtyard, which had been unlit so far, startled everyone as it exploded into a brilliant blue-green flame, reaching like a pillar into the sky. Once more, from the darkness above, the Gilarabrin screamed at them. The emerald inferno slowly burned down. The flames lost their green color and diminished until only natural flames remained. The fires crackled and hissed, sending storms of sparks skyward. The men in the courtyard stared upward, but there were no further signs of the beast. Only darkness and the distant sound of crickets. Chapter 6 The Contest. "I can assure you, Your Royal Majesty," Arista said in her most congenial voice, "there will be no change in foreign or domestic policy under King Ulrich's reign. He will continue to pursue the same agenda as our father, upholding the dignity and honour of the House of Essendon. Melengar will continue to remain your friendly neighbour to the west." Arista stood before the King of Dunmore in her mother's best dress, the stunning silver silk gown. 40 buttons lined the sleeves. Dozens of feet of crushed velvet trimmed the embroidered bodice and full skirt. The rounded neckline clung to her shoulders. She stood erect, chin high, eyes forward, hands folded. King Roswert, who sat on his throne wearing furs that looked to have come from wolves, drained his cup and belched. He was short and immensely fat. His round, pudgy face sagged under its own weight, gathering at the bottom and forming three full chins. His eyes were half closed, his lips were wet, and she was certain she could see a bit of spittle dribbling down through the folds of his neck. His wife, Frida, sat beside him. She, too, was large, but thin by comparison. Whereas the king seeped liquid, she was dry as a desert, in both looks and manner. The throne room was small, with a wooden floor and beams that supported a lofty cathedral ceiling. Protruding from the walls were heads of stags and moose, each covered in enough dust to make its fur look grey. Near the door stood the famous 9-foot stuffed bear named Oswald, its claws up, mouth open, snarling. Dunmore legend held that Oswald killed 5 knights and an unknown number of peasants before King Ogden, King Roswert's grandfather, slew him with nothing more than a dagger. That had been 70 years earlier, when Glamrendor was just a frontier fort, and Dunmore little more than a forest with trails. Roswort himself couldn't claim such glory. He had abandoned the hunting traditions of his sires in favour of courtly life, and it showed. The king held up his cup and shook it. Arista waited, and the king yawned. Somewhere behind her, loud heels crossed the throne room. There was a muttering, then the heels again, followed by the snapping of fingers. Finally, a figure approached the dais, thin and delicate. An elf. He was dressed in a rough woolen uniform of dull brown. Around his neck was a heavy iron collar that was riveted in place. He approached with a pitcher and filled the king's cup, then backed away. The king drank, tipping the cup too high, wine dribbling down, leaving a faint pink line and a droplet dangling from his stubbly whiskers. He belched again, this time more loudly, and sighed with contentment. The king looked back at Arista.
"But what about this matter of Braga's death?"
Roswert asked.
"Do you have evidence to show that he was involved in this so-called conspiracy?"
"He tried to kill me."
"Yes, so you say. But even if he did, he had good reason, it seems. Braga was a good and devout Nephron, and you are, after all, a witch."
Aristus squeezed her hands together. It was not for the first time, and her fingers were starting to ache. "Forgive me, Your Royal Majesty, but I fear you may be misinformed on that subject."
"Misinformed? I have..."
He coughed. Coughed again, then spat on the floor beside the throne. Frida glared rigidly at the elf until he stepped over and wiped it up with the bottom of his tunic.
"I have very good information gatherers," the king went on, "who tell me both Braga and Bishop Soldor brought you to trial to answer charges of witchcraft and the murder of your father. Immediately afterwards, Braga was dead, decapitated, and accused of the very charges he levelled against you. Now you come before us as Ambassador of Melengar, a woman. I fear this is all too convenient for my tastes."
"Braga also accused me of killing His Royal Majesty King Ulric, who appointed me to this office. Or do you also deny his existence?" The royal eyebrows rose.
"You are young," he said coldly. "This is your first audience as ambassador. I'll ignore your affront this time. Insult me again, and I'll have you expelled from my kingdom."
Arista bowed her head silently.
"It does not bode well with us that the throne of Melengar was taken by blood," nor that House Essendon pays only lip service to the Church. Also, your kingdom's tolerance for elves is disgusting. You let the vile beasts run free. Navron never meant for this to be. The Church teaches us that the elf is a disease. They must be broken into service or vanquished altogether. They are like rats, and Melengar is the woodpile next door. Yes, I have no doubt that Ulric will continue his father's policies. Both were born with blinders. Changes are coming, and I can already see that Melengar is too foolish to bend with the wind. All the better for Dunmore, I think.
Arista opened her mouth, but the king held up a finger.
This interview is over. Go back to your brother and tell him we fulfilled the favour of seeing you and were not impressed.
The king and queen stood together and walked out through the rear archway, leaving Arista facing two empty wooden chairs. The elf, which stood nearby, watched her intently but said nothing. She half considered going on with the rest of her prepared speech. The level of futility would remain. Empty thrones could not be any less responsive, and most certainly would be more polite. She sighed. Her shoulders drooped. Could it have gone any worse? She turned and walked out, listening to her beautiful dress rustling. She stepped outside the castle gate and looked down at the city. Deep, baked ruts scarred the uneven dirt roads, so rough and littered with rocks they appeared as dry riverbeds. Sun bleached the tight rows of similarly framed wooden buildings to a pale grey. Most of the residents wore drab colours, clothes made of undyed wool or linen. Dozens of people with weary faces sat on corners or wandered about aimlessly with hands out. They appeared invisible to those walking by. It was Arista's first visit to Glamrendor, the capital of Dunmore. She shook her head and muttered softly, "We have seen you too." Despite the meagre offerings, the city was bustling, but she suspected few of those rushing by were locals. It was easy to tell the difference. Those from out of town wore shoes. Wagons, carriages, coaches and horses flowed through the centre of the capital that morning, all heading east. The Church had opened the contest to all comers, common and noble alike. It was their shot at glory, wealth, and fame. Her own coach waited, flying the Melengar Falcon, and Hilfred stood holding the door. Bernice sat inside with a tray of sweets on her lap and a smile on her lips.
"How did it go, my dear? Were you impressive?"
"No, I wasn't impressive. But we are also not at war, so I should thank Maribor for that kindness." She sat opposite Bernice, making certain to pull the full length of her gown inside the door before Hilfred closed it.
"Have a gingerbread man?"
Bernice asked, holding up the tray with a look of pity that included pushing out her lower lip.
"He's bound to steal the pain away."
"Where is Sawley?" she asked, seeing the man-shaped cookies.
"He said he had some things to speak to the Archbishop about, and would ride in his Grace's coach. He hoped you didn't mind."
Arista did not mind, and only wished Bernice had joined him. She was tired of the constant company, and missed the solitude of her tower. She took a cookie and felt the carriage rock as Hilfred climbed up with the driver. The coach lurched, and they were off, bouncing over the rutted road. "These are stale," Arista said, with a mouthful of gingerbread that was hard and sandy. Bernice looked horrified.
"I'm so sorry.
Where did you get them?"
"A little bakery up."
She started to point out the window, but the movement of the carriage confused her. She looked around, and gave up, and put her hand down again.
"Oh, I don't know now. But it was a very nice shop, and I thought you might need, you know, something to help you feel better after the meeting."
"Need them?"
Bernice nodded her head with a forced smile, and reaching out, she patted the princess's hand and said,
"It's not your fault, dear. It really isn't fair of His Majesty to put you in this position."
"I should stay in Medford and receive suitors," Arista guessed.
"Exactly. This just isn't right."
"Neither is this cookie."
She placed the gingerbread man back on the tray, minus the leg she'd bitten off. She then sat raking her tongue with her upper teeth like a cat with hair in its mouth.
"At least His Royal Majesty must have been impressed by how you looked," Bernice said, eyeing her with pride. "You're beautiful."
Arista gave her a sidelong glance.
"The dress is beautiful."
"Of course it is, but..."
"Oh, dear, Maribor!"
Arista cut her off as she glanced out the window.
"How many are there now? It'll be like travelling with an army."
As the carriage reached the end of town, she saw the masses. There could be as many as 300 men standing behind the banners of the Nephron Church. They all waited in a single line, but they couldn't have been more different. The muscular, scrawny, tall and short. All ranks were represented. Knights, soldiers, nobles and peasants. Some wore armour, some silk, others linen or wool. They sat on chargers, draft horses, ponies, mules, or inside coaches, open-air carriages, wagons and buckboards. They appeared a strange and unlikely assortment, but each bore the same smile of expectation and excitement, all eyes looking east. Arista's first official session as ambassador was finished. As bad as it had been, it was over. With Sawley gone, she could shelve thoughts of church and state, guilt and blame. Stress that had smothered her for days evaporated, and at last she was able to feel the growing excitement that bubbled all around her. From everywhere people rushed to join the growing train. Some arrived with nothing but a small linen bag tucked under one arm, while others led their own personal train of pack horses. There were those who commanded multiple wagons loaded with tents, food and clothes. One well-dressed merchant carried velvet-upholstered chairs and a canopy bed on top of a wagon. A loud banging hammered the roof of the coach, shocking both of them. Gingerbread men flew.
"Oh, dear!" Bernice gasped.
A moment later, Marvin Pickering's head appeared in the window, looking down and inside from the back of his horse, so that his dark hair hung wildly.
"So, how did it go?" he grinned mischievously. "Do I need to prepare for war?"
Arista scowled.
"That good, huh?"
Marvin went on, heedless of the commotion he had caused.
"We'll talk later. I have to find Fannin before he starts dueling someone. Hiya, Hilfred. This is going to be great. When was the last time we were all camping together? See ya."
Bernice was fanning herself with both hands, staring up at the roof of the coach, her mouth slack. Seeing her and the little army of gingerbread men scattered on the benches, in the curtains, on the floor and in her lap, Arista couldn't help smiling.
"You are right, Bernice. The cookies did cheer me up."
"See him?" Fannin pointed to the man in the brown suede doublet. "That's Sir Endon, possibly the greatest living knight after Sir Brecton." After another day's travel that left her drowsy, Arista was at the Pickerings' camp, hiding from Bernice. The two boys shared an elegant single-pick tent of alternating gold and green stripes, which they had pitched at the eastern edge of the main camp. The three sat out front under the scallop-edged canopy, held up by two tall wooden poles. On the left flew the gold falcon on the red field of the House of Essendon. On the right, the gold sword on the green field of the House of Pickering. It was a modest camp compared to most of the nobles. Some looked like small castles and took hours for a team of servants to erect. The Pickerings travelled lightly, carrying everything they needed on their stallions and two pack horses. They didn't have tables or chairs, and Arista sprawled in a modest gown on a sheet of canvas. If Bernice saw, the old woman would have a heart attack. Arista didn't mind. She thought it was wonderful to lie back and stretch out under the sky. It reminded her of Summer's Rule when they were kids. At night, the adults would dance and the children would lie on the south hill at the Pickerings' home of Drondel Fields, counting the falling stars and fireflies. It had been all of them then. Morvin, Fanon, Ulrich, even Lenaire, back before the boy's sister became too much of a lady. She remembered the feel of the cool night breeze rushing over her, the sensation of grass on her bare feet, the vast spray of stars above, and the faint melody of the band as it played Cailleed Portmore, the Galilean folk song. "And there, see the large man in the green tunic? That's Sir Gravan. He's a quester. He does most of his work for the Church of Nephron. You know, recovering artifacts, slaying monsters, those kinds of things. He's known to be one of the greatest adventurers alive. He's from Vernez. That's all the way down near Delgos."
"I know where Vernez is, Fanon," Arista replied.
"That's right. You have to know all that stuff now, don't you?" Marvin said.
"Your high exalted ambassadorship?"
The elder Pickering offered an elaborate, seated bow. "Laugh now. Just you wait," she told him. "You'll get yours. One day you'll be Marquis. Then it won't be all fun and games. You'll have responsibilities, mister."
"I won't," Fanon said sadly.
If not for his being 3 years younger, Fanon could be Marvin's twin. Both had the dashing Pickering features, sharp, angled faces, dark, thick hair, bright white teeth, and sweeping shoulders that tapered to narrow, athletic waists. Fanon was just leaner and a bit shorter, and unlike Marvin, whose hair was always a frightful mess, Fanon kept his neatly combed.
"That's why you need to win this thing," Marvin told his brother. "And, of course, you will, because you're a Pickering, and Pickerings never fail. Look at that guy over there. He doesn't stand a chance."
Arista didn't bother sitting up. He'd been doing this all night, pointing out people and explaining how he could tell by the way they walked or wore their swords that Fanon could best them. She had no doubt he was right. She was just tired of hearing it.
"What is the prize for this contest?" she asked.
"They haven't said yet," Fanon muttered. "Gold, most likely," Marvin replied. "In the form of some award. But that's not what makes it valuable. It's the prestige. Once Fanon takes this trophy, he'll have a name. Well, he already has the Pickering name, but he hasn't any titles yet. Once he does, opportunities will open up for him. Of course, it could be land. Then he'd be set."
"I hope so. I certainly don't want to end up at a monastery."
"Do you still write poetry, Fanon?" Arista asked.
"I haven't. In a while."
"It was good. What I remember, at least. You used to write all the time. What happened?"
"He learned the poetry of the sword. It'll serve him far better than the pen," Marvin answered for him.
"Who's that?" Fanon asked, pointing to the west.
"That's Retinol," Marvin replied. "The self-proclaimed genius. Get this. He's brought this thing, a huge contraption, with him."
"Why?"
"He says it's for the contest."
"What is it?"
Marvin shrugged. "Don't know, but it's big. He keeps it covered under a tarp and wails like a girl whenever the wagon team bounces it through a rut."
"Say, isn't that Prince Rudolf?"
"Where?"
Arista popped her head up, moving to her elbows. Marvin chuckled.
"Just kidding. Ulrich told us about your misunderstanding."
"Have you met Rudolf?" she asked.
"Actually, I have," Marvin said. "The man has donkeys wondering why they got stuck with him as a namesake."
It took a second, then Fanon and Arista broke into laughter, dragging Marvin with them.
He's a royal git, that's certain, and I'd have been plenty upset if I thought I was facing a life kissing that ass. Honestly, Arista, I'm surprised you didn't turn Ulrich into a toad or something.
Arista stopped laughing.
What? You know, put a hex on him, a weak as a frog would.
What's wrong?
Nothing, she said, lying back down and turning onto her stomach.
Hey, look, I didn't mean anything.
It's okay, she lied. It was just a joke. Your first joke was better.
Arista, I know you're not a witch.
A long, uncomfortable silence followed.
I'm sorry, Marvin offered.
Took you long enough, she said.
It could have been worse, Fannin spoke up.
Ulrich could have forced you to marry Marvin.
That's really sick, Arista said, rolling over and sitting up.
Marvin looked at her with hurt, surprised eyes. She shook her head.
I just meant it would be like marrying a brother. I've always thought of you all as family.
Don't tell Denik, Marvin replied. He's had a crush on you for years.
Seriously?
Oh, and don't tell him I told you either. Better yet, just forget I said that.
What about those two?
Fannin asked abruptly, pointing toward a massive red and black striped tent from which two men had just exited. One was huge, with a wild red moustache and beard. He wore a sleeveless scarlet tunic with a green-draped sash and a metal cap with several dents in it. The other man was tall and thin, with long black hair and a short, trimmed beard. He was dressed in a red cassock and black cape, with the symbol of a broken crown on his chest.
I don't think you want to mess with either of them, Marvin finally said. That's Lord Rufus of Trent, warlord of Lingard, a clan leader and veteran of dozens of battles against the wild men of Estrendor. Not to mention being the hero of the Battle of Ilan Hills.
That's Rufus, Fannin muttered. I've heard he's got the temperament of a shrew, and the arm of a bear.
Who's the other guy? The one with the broken crown standard?
Fannin asked, pointing at the other man.
That, my dear brother, is a sentinel, and let's just hope this is the closest either of us ever get to one.
While Arista was watching the two men, she saw a silhouette appear against the light of the distant campfire, very short, with a long beard and puffy sleeves.
By the way, I want to start early tomorrow, Fannin, his brother said. I want to get out ahead of the train. I'm tired of eating dust.
Anyone know exactly where we're going? Fannin asked. It feels like we're travelling to the end of the world.
Arista nodded. I heard Solly talking about it with the Archbishop. I think it's a little village called Dahlgren.
She looked back, trying to find the figure once more, but it was gone.
Chapter 7 Of Elves and Men. Thrace lay on the Margrave's bed in the manor house, her head carefully wrapped in strips of cloth. Her hair was bunched and snarled, blonde strands slipping out between the bandages. Purple and yellow bruises swelled around her eyes and nose. Her upper lip puffed up to twice its size, and a line of dark, dried blood ran its length. Thrace coughed and mumbled, but never spoke, never opened her eyes. And Theron never left her side. Ezra Harden ordered Lena to boil feverfew leaves in a big pot of apple cider vinegar. She did as he instructed. Everyone did now. After the previous night, the residents of Dahlgren treated the cripple with newfound respect and looked at him with awe and a bit of fear. It was Tad Bothwig and Rose McDern who had seen him raise the green fire that had chased away the beast. No one said the word witch or wizard. No one had to. Soon the steam from the pot filled the room with a pungent, flowery odour.
I'm so sorry,
Theron whispered to his daughter. The coughing and mumbling had stopped, and she lay still as death. He held her limp hand to his cheek, unsure if she could hear him. He had been saying that for hours, begging her to wake up.
"I didn't mean it. I was just so angry. I'm so sorry. Don't leave. Please come back to me."
He could still hear the sound in the dark of his daughter's cry, cut horribly short by a muffled crack. If it had been a tree trunk or a thicker branch, Theron guessed, she would have died instantly. As it was, she still might die. No one but Lena and Ezra Harden dared enter the room that Theron filled with his grief. They all expected the worst. Blood had covered the girl's face and her father's shirt by the time they arrived at the manor. Skin white, lips an odd bluish hue, Thrace hadn't moved nor opened her eyes. Ezra Harden had whispered to her and instructed them to take the girl to the manor and keep her warm. It was the kind of thing one did for the dying, making them as comfortable as possible. Deacon Thomas had prayed for her and remained on hand to bless her departing soul. In the past year, the village of Dahlgren had seen many deaths. Not all were by the beast. There were the normal accidents and sicknesses, and in winter wolves hunted the area. There were also some unexplained disappearances. Often attributed to the beast, they could just as likely have been the result of getting lost in the forest or accidentally falling in the Nidwalden. In no more than a year, over half the village's population had perished or gone missing. Everyone knew someone who had died, and nearly every family had lost at least one member. The people of Dahlgren had grown accustomed to death. He was a nightly visitor, a guest at every breakfast table. They knew his face, the sound of his voice, the way he walked, his peculiar habits. He was always there. If it weren't for the mess he left, they might neglect to notice him altogether. No one expected Thrace to survive. The sun came up, casting a dull light into the room where Theron wept for his daughter. The last of his family was leaving him. Only now he realized how much she meant to him. Thoughts came, uninvited, to his mind. Time and time again, it had been she who had always come for him. He remembered the night the beast attacked his farm, when he was coming home late. Only she had braved the darkness to search for him. It was Thrace, a young girl, little more than a child, who had travelled alone halfway across Avon and spent her life savings to bring him help. Then, the previous night, when his stubbornness had kept him at the farm, she had come to him in the darkness, running alone through the forest, ignoring the dangers. There had been only one thought in her mind: to save him. She had succeeded. She had deprived the beast of his flesh, but more than that, she had pulled him back into the world of the living. She had ripped the black veil away from his eyes and freed his heart from the weight of guilt. But the price had been her life. Tears ran down his cheeks. They hung on his upper lip. He kissed his daughter's hand, leaving a wet spot, an offering, an apology.
"How could I have been so blind?"
The even, constant breaths his daughter took slowed with each inhale, less frequent, shorter than the one before. He listened to their descent like the sound of footsteps receding, walking away, growing fainter, quieter. He clutched her hand, kissing it repeatedly and rubbing it to his wet cheek. It felt like his heart was being ripped out through his chest. At last, the regular pace of her breathing stopped. Theron sobbed.
"Oh, God!"
"Daddy?"
He jerked his head up. His daughter's eyes were open. She was looking at him.
"Are you all right?
she whispered. His mouth opened, but he couldn't speak. His tears continued to flow, and like a barren bit of land seeing water for the first time in years, a smile of joy grew on his face. Swift clouds moved across a capricious sky, as growing winds and the portents of a coming storm marked the new day. Royce sat on the rock ledge where the cliff met the river, and the spray of the falls dampened the stone. His feet and legs were soaked from a morning spent trekking through the damp forest underbrush. His eyes stared out across the ridgeline of the falls at the promontory rock, and the towering citadel that sat tantalizingly upon it. He thought that perhaps there might be a tunnel running under the river. He looked for an access in the trees, but found nothing. He was getting nowhere. After almost 2 days, he was no closer to his goal. The tower still lay out of reach. Unless he could learn to swim the current, walk on water, or fly, he had no chance of traversing the gulf that lay between. "They're over there right now, you know," Ezra Hardin said. Royce had forgotten about the wizard. He had arrived some time earlier, mentioning only that Thrace had survived, was awake, and looked to make a full recovery. After that, he took a seat on a rock and spent the next hour or so staring across the river, much as Royce had done all day. Who? The elves. They're on their side of the river, looking back at us. They can see us, I suspect, even at this range. They're surprising like that. Most humans consider them inferior, lazy, filthy, uneducated creatures, but the fact is they are superior to humans in nearly every way. I suppose that's why humans are so quick to denounce them. They're unwilling to concede that they may be second best. Elves are truly remarkable. Just look at that tower. It's fluid and seamless, as if growing right out of the rock. How elegant. How perfect. It fits into the landscape like a thing of nature, a natural wonder. Only it isn't. They created it using skills and techniques that our best masons couldn't begin to understand. Just imagine how glorious their cities must be. What wonders those forests across the river must hold.
So you've never crossed the river? Royce asked.
No man ever has, and no man is ever likely to. The moment a man touches that far shore, he will fall dead. The thread by which the fate of man hangs is a thin one indeed.
How's that?
Ezra Hardin only smiled. Did you know that no human army ever won a battle against the elves before the arrival of Navron? At that time, elves were our demons. The great library of Persepolis had reams on it. Once we even thought they were gods. Their lifespan is so long that no one noticed them aging. Their death rites are so secret no human has ever seen an elven corpse. They were the firstborn, the children of Ferol, great and powerful. In combat they were feared above all things. Sickness could be treated, bears and wolves could be hunted and trapped, storms and droughts prepared for, but nothing, nothing could stand before the elves. Their blades broke ours, their arrows pierced our armor, their shields were impenetrable, and, of course, they knew the art. Imagine a sky darkened with a host of Gilarabrin, and they are only one of their weapons. Even without all that, without the art, their speed, eyesight, hearing, balance, and ancient skills are all beyond the abilities of man.
If that's true, how come they're over there and we're sitting here?
It is all because of Navron. He showed us their weaknesses. He taught mankind how to fight, how to defend,
and he taught us the art of magic. Without it, we were naked and helpless against them.
I still don't see how we won, Royce challenged.
Even with that knowledge, they still seem to have the advantage.
True, and in an even fight we would have lost, but it wasn't even. You see, elves live for a very long time. I don't think any human actually knows how long, but they live for many centuries at least. There may be elves right now watching us that remember what Navron looked like. But no people can live that long and reproduce quickly. Elves have few children, and a birth for them is quite significant. Birth and death in the elven world are rare and holy things. Imagine the devastation and misery it must have been for them during the wars. No matter how many battles they won against us, each time their numbers were fewer than before. While we humans recovered our losses in a generation, it would take a millennium for elves. They were consumed, drowned, if you will, in a flooding sea of humanity.
Ezra Hardin paused, then added,
Only now, Navron is gone.
There will be no savior this time.
This time?
What do you think keeps them over there?
These are their lands. To us it seems eons ago, but to them it is just yesterday when they walked this side of the river. By now their numbers have likely recovered.
What keeps them on that side of the river, then?
What keeps anyone from what they want?
Fear.
Fear of annihilation. Fear that we would destroy them utterly. But Navron is dead.
You mentioned that, Royce pointed out. I told you before that mankind has squandered the legacy of Navron, and it has done so at its own peril. Navron brought magic to man, but Navron is gone, and the magic forgotten. We sit here like children, naked and unarmed. Mankind is inviting the wrath of a race so far beyond us they won't even hear our cries. The elves' ignorance of our weakness and this fragile agreement between the Erevan Empire and a dead emperor is all that remains of humanity's defense.
It's a good thing they don't know, then.
That's just it.
The wizard told him.
They are learning.
The Gilarabrin. Ezra Hardin nodded.
According to Navron's decree, the banks of the river Nidwalden are Ryan Contita.
Off limits to everyone, Royce roughly translated, garnering a faint smile from the wizard. I can read and write, too.
Ah, a truly educated man. So, as I was saying, the banks of the river Nidwalden are Ryan Contita.
A look of realization washed over the thief's face. Dahlgren is in violation of the treaty.
Exactly. The decree also stipulates that elves are forbidden to take human lives, except should they cross the river. It says nothing about humans killed through benign actions. If I release a boulder, it could roll anywhere, but odds are it will roll downhill. If houses and people are downhill, it may destroy them, but it isn't me that's killing them, it's the boulder, and the unfortunate fact they live downhill from it.
And they're watching what we do, how we deal with it. They're sizing up our strengths and weaknesses.
Much like you're doing with me.
Ezra Hardin smiled.
Perhaps, he said.
There is no way to be certain if they're responsible for the beast's presence, but one thing is certain. They are watching. When they see we are helpless against one Gilarabrin, if they feel the treaty is broken, or when it runs out, fear will no longer be a deterrent.
Is that why you're really here?
No, The wizard shook his head. It plays a part, but the war between the elves and man will come despite any action I can take. I am merely trying to lessen the blow and give humanity a fighting chance.
You might begin by teaching some others to do what you did last night.
The wizard looked at the thief. What do you mean?
Coy doesn't suit you, Boyce told him.
No, I suppose not.
I thought you couldn't do your art without your hands.
It's very hard and takes a great deal of time, and it isn't very accurate.
Imagine trying to write your name with your toes.
I began working on that spell before you arrived here, thinking it would come in handy at some point. As it was, the flame wall nearly consumed you two. It was supposed to be several yards farther away, and last for hours instead of minutes. With hands, I could have...
He trailed off.
No sense going there, I suppose.
Were you really that powerful before?
Ezra Harden showed him a wicked smile.
Oh, my dear boy, you couldn't begin to imagine.
Word of Thrace's recovery quickly spread through the village. She was still a little groggy, but remarkably sound. She could see clearly, all her teeth were in her head, and she had an appetite. By mid-morning she was sitting up, eating soup. That day, there was a decidedly different look in the villagers' eyes. The unspoken thought in every mind was the same. The beast had attacked, and no one had died. Most had seen the winged beast outlined in the brilliant green flames that night. Alongside each of them that morning walked a strange companion, a long-lost friend who had returned unexpectedly. Hope. They got busy at dawn, preparing more wood fires. They had a system down now, and were able to build up the piles with just a few hours' work. Suspecting that the beast, obviously able to see well in the dark, might not be able to see through thick smoke, Vince Griffin suggested they use smudge pots. For centuries, farmers had used smudge pots to drive off insects that threatened to devour their crops, and Dahlgren was no different. Old pots were promptly gathered and filled, as if a cloud of locusts was on its way. At the same time, Hadrian, Tad Botherwick, and Klein Goodman began surveying the outbuildings of the Lower Bailey for the best shelters. Hadrian busied himself organizing small groups of men. One group started to expand the cellar they had found in the smokehouse, and another went to work digging a tunnel with the idea of trying to capture the beast. A huge serpent chasing a man might follow him into a tunnel, but if the tunnel gradually narrowed, they might be able to seal the exits before it realized its mistake. No weapon made by man might be able to slay it, but Hadrian guessed there were no restrictions on imprisoning the beast. Deacon Thomas was far from delighted with all the digging, cutting and burning inside the castle grounds, but already it was clear that the villagers had found a new leader in Hadrian. Thomas remained quietly indoors, caring for Thrace.
Hadrian.
He was washing at the well in the village, where he could find some privacy, when he looked up to see Theron.
Been doing some digging, I see, the farmer said. Dylan mentioned you had them making a tunnel. Pretty smart thinking.
The odds of it working are slim, Hadrian explained, dousing his face with handfuls of water. But at least it's a shot.
Listen.
The farmer began with a pained look on his face, and then said nothing.
Thrace is doing well, Hadrian asked after a minute or so.
She's great, as solid as her old man, he said proudly, thumping his own chest. It'll take more than a tree to break her. That's the thing about us woods. We might not look like it, but we're a strong lot. It might take us a while, but we come back, and when we do, we're stronger than ever. Thing is, we need something. You know, a reason. I didn't have one. At least, I didn't think I did. Thrace showed me different.
They stood facing each other in an awkward silence.
Listen,
Theron said again, and once more paused.
I'm not used to being beholden to anyone, you see. I've always paid my own way. I got what I have by work, and lots of it. I don't ask anyone's help, and I don't apologize for the way I am, see?
Hadrian nodded.
But, well, a lot of what you said yesterday was true. Only today, some things are different. You follow? Thrace and me. We're going to be leaving this place as soon as she's able. I'm figuring a couple of days' rest and she'll be okay to travel. We'll head south. Maybe to Alburn or even Calais. I hear it stays warm longer there. Better growing season. Anyway, that still leaves us a few nights we'll be here. A few more nights we'll have to live under this shadow. I'm not going to lose my little girl, the way I lost the others. Now, I know an old farmer like me ain't much good to her, swinging a scythe or pitchfork against that thing, but if it comes to that, it would be good if I knew how to fight proper. That way, if it comes calling before we leave, at least there will be a chance. Now, I haven't got much, but I do have some silver set aside, and I was wondering if your offer to teach me how to fight was still good.
First, we need to get something straight, Hadrian told him sternly. Your daughter already paid us in full to do whatever we could to help you. So you keep your silver for the trip south, or I won't teach you a thing, agreed?
Theron hesitated, then nodded.
Good. Well, I suppose we can begin right now if you're ready.
Should we get your swords? Theron asked.
That would be a problem, considering I put my swords on Millie last night, and no one has seen us since. But that shouldn't matter for now.
Should I cut sticks, then? The farmer asked.
No.
What, then?
How about sitting down and just listening? There's a lot to learn before you're ready to swing at anything.
Theron looked at Hadrian skeptically.
You want me to teach you, right? If I said I wanted you to teach me to be a great farmer in a few hours, what would you say?
Theron nodded in submission and sat down on the dirt not far from where Hadrian had first met Pearl. Hadrian slipped his shirt on, took a bucket, turned it over, and sat down in front of him.
As with everything, fighting takes practice. Anything can look easy if you're watching someone who's mastered whatever it is they're doing. But what you don't see is the hours and years of effort that go into perfecting their craft. I'm sure you can plow a field in a fraction of the time it would take me, for this very reason. Sword fighting's no different. Practice will allow you to react without thought to events, and even to anticipate those events. It becomes a form of foresight, the ability to look into the future and know exactly what your opponent will do even before he does. Without practice, you'll need to think too much. When fighting a more skilled opponent, even a split second of hesitation can get you killed.
My opponent is a giant snake with wings, Theron said,
and it has killed more than a score of men. Most certainly a more skilled opponent, wouldn't you say? So, practice is paramount. The question is, what do you need to practice?
Swinging a sword, I should think.
True, but that's only a small part of it. If it were merely swinging a sword, everyone with two legs and at least one arm would be experts. No, there's much more to it. First, there is concentration. That means more than just paying attention to the fight. It means not worrying about Thrace, or thinking about your family, the past, or the future. It means focusing on what you're doing beyond all else. It might sound easy, but it isn't. Next comes breathing.
Breathing?
Theron asked dubiously.
Yeah, I know we breathe all the time, but sometimes we stop breathing or stop breathing correctly. Ever get startled and discover you are holding your breath? Ever find yourself panting when you're really nervous or frightened? Some people can actually pass out that way. Trust me, in a real fight you'll be scared, and unless you train, you'll end up breathing shallow, or not at all. Less air saps your body of strength and makes it hard to think clearly. You'll become tired and slow, something you can't afford in a battle. So, how do you breathe correctly? Theron asked, still with a hint of sarcasm. You have to breathe deep and slow, even before you need to, before your exertion demands it. At first, it'll be a conscious thought, and it'll feel counterproductive, even distracting. But over time, it'll become second nature. It's also good to keep in mind that you have the most strength for a blow on an exhale. It adds power and focus to a stroke. Sometimes, actually yelling or shouting helps. I'll want you to do that during your training. I want to hear it when you swing. Later on, it won't be necessary, although sometimes it can help to startle your opponent. Adrian paused briefly, and Theron noted a faint hint of a smile tug at his lips. Next comes balance, and that means more than not falling down. Sadly, humans only have 2 feet. That's only 2 points to support us. Pick up one and you're vulnerable. This is why you want to keep your feet on the ground. That doesn't mean you don't move, but when you move, you slide your feet rather than pick them up. You need to keep your weight forward, your knees slightly bent, and your balance on the balls of your feet rather than in your heels. Drawing your feet together reduces your 2 points of balance to 1. So keep your feet apart, about shoulder width. Timing is, of course, very important. I warn you now, you'll be terrible at it to begin with, as timing improves with experience. You saw from swinging at me yesterday how frustrating it can be to swing and miss. Timing is what allows you to hit, and not only to hit, but also to do damage. You'll learn to see patterns in movement. You'll know when to expect an opening or a weakness. Frequently, you can anticipate an attack by watching how your opponent moves. The placement of his feet, the look in his eyes, the telltale drop of his shoulder, the tightening of a muscle.
But I'm not a fighting person, Theron interrupted, and I don't even think it has a shoulder.
Even animals give signs about what they'll do. They hunch up, twist, and shift their weight just like people. Such signals don't have to be obvious. Most skilled fighters will try to mask their intentions, or worse, purposely try to mislead you. They want to confuse your timing, throw you off balance, and make an opening for themselves. Of course, this is exactly what you want to do to them. If done well, your opponent sees the false move, but not the attack. The result, in your case, is a headless flying serpent. The last thing to learn is the hardest. It can't be taught. It can barely be explained. It's the idea that the fight, the battle, doesn't really exist so much in your hands or your feet, but in your head. The real struggle is in your own mind. You must know you're going to win before you start to fight. You have to see it, smell it, and believe it utterly. It's a form of confidence, but you must guard against overconfidence. You have to be flexible, able to adapt in an instant, and never allow yourself to give up. Without this, nothing else is possible. Unless you believe you'll win, fear and hesitation will hold you down while your opponent kills you. Now, let's get a couple of stout sticks, and we'll see how well you listened. That night, they lit bonfires once more, and everyone stayed sheltered in either the manor house or the cellar of the smokehouse. Royce and Hadrian were the only two moving outside, and even they remained in the shelter of the smokehouse doorway, watching the night by bonfire light. "How's Thrace doing?" Royce asked, his eyes on the sky.
"Great, considering the fact that she broke a tree branch with her head," Hadrian replied, as he sat in a barrel, cleaning a mutton bone of the last